Fundamentally, the monk is, and the monk is in a certain sense an archetype, one could say, that the human spirit in search of the divine. You could say every human being is touched in one way or another by that tendency. I mean, there's lots of people who say that there is no God, but there must be very few who are not touched in some way by things bigger than themselves, you know, things beautiful, things that evoke something within them. So the monastic spirit is the spirit that longs for God and seeks God.
The longing for God has led monks throughout the centuries to seek quiet, lonely places in order to listen to God more attentively.
The normal way, or the very common natural way to do that, is in prayer, which is the communication or the attempt to communicate or be in the presence of this divine reality. Now, very often that requires, for example, quite concrete things like stillness and silence, and those are things that maybe are not very easily found in the context of the city. So monks have often gone into the wilds, originally into the deserts, but also into the countryside, into the mountains, because these places, with their silence, with their grandeur, can actually touch the human spirit and provide the suitable context in which the heart can call to God and hear God.
Even in a busy city monastery such as St. Paul's outside the walls in Rome, the monks still find silence for prayer. Abbot Edmund Power, the abbot of St. Paul's, explains.
We at St. Paul's, we're stuck in the middle of the city, which is fine. You know, we're a big traffic island now, but we were outside the city when the monastery was built. It was sort of in the countryside. But even in a city monastery, you know, it just means that you establish your silence and your solitude, in a way, within the walls. Because fundamentally, there's external silence, but external silence serves the development of internal silence. And internal silence is helped by external, but isn't totally dependent on it. So I think any human being, a man or woman, in whatever context, a city or country, could gradually find that silence within themselves, which is the context where they find God.
The late Cardinal Hume, himself a Benedictine monk, remarked that it is all right to say that work is prayer, provided there is also prayer that has nothing to do with work. Abbot Edmund comments,
"That's an interesting way of looking at it. People say traditionally the Benedictine motto is ora et lavora, pray and work. And I think that St. Benedict never actually says that explicitly, but there's a truth in it, because his vision of the Benedictine life is a life of prayer, certainly, but a life also of service, work and service of the brethren, of your brothers or sisters in community, and then also of people who come, you know, the guests, the poor, all those who come to the monastery, because it always... traditionally, the monastery has always become a centre of a region, and you know, people come to it. But I suppose people could go to one extreme and say, in fact, what you show your love of God by your love of others. In other words, your work for others is your prayer.
But work must not be allowed to take priority. We all need time alone with God.
It's true that a lot of people are very activist, you know, they do things, they want to be at it all the time, working away. And there's some monks like that as well, who are very, very active workaholics. But the spirit, the human spirit, needs to soar as well. It needs to rise and to have the perspective on everything, you know, and then the work is lifted as well. I mean, the work can become just a kind of drudgery. You can lose yourself in service of others, which is in effect a real losing yourself, not losing yourself to find your real identity, which is what Christ speaks about, but losing yourself and losing, and that's it. So, you know, it really, the work needs to be motivated and rooted in the prayer. So I think, yeah, my humble opinion, Cardinal Hume was probably right.
Another comment made by Cardinal Hume was that St. Francis of Assisi would have driven a Benedictine community mad. There is a big difference between the Benedictine and Franciscan ways of looking at the concept of community, as Abbot Edmund explains.
The Benedictine model is that people come together, inspired by the same vision, the same search for God, and root themselves in an area of the world and make that world, that area, creative. In other words, the work, like farming or whatever, you actually mould your environment so that it becomes a reflection of God's creation and a context in which God can be found. So Benedictines have developed farming and all the rest of it, you know, and stable work within a context. Now, obviously, this way of working generates wealth. It's natural. If you work steadily and disciplined way in one area and you're not nomads, you know, you generate wealth. And so Benedictines became landowners, became quite wealthy collectively. St. Francis comes along, young and enthusiastic, wants to throw off everything, literally. Remember the incident where he strips off his clothes in Assisi. He wants a life of complete renunciation. And so he starts off all inspired. But is it possible? It's only possible because of Benedictines. Now, I'm talking in a symbolic way. It's because there is stable, organized prosperity that people can reject it and be supported by it because they're mendicants. I mean, if they go and beg, who are they begging from? Those who are working stably and creating the wealth. If everybody did what Francis did, everybody would die. If everybody did what Benedict did, everybody would live. Now, I'm not saying Benedict's charisma is more important than Francis's, because I think Francis has something very important to say to people who can become too rooted in their stability and their economic security, and it's a temptation sometimes for Benedictines. So they need, in a sense, the prophetic voice of Francis, sort of saying, you know, oh, this doesn't matter.
Yet the early Franciscans themselves found that they needed some structures to their community living.
There was a brother Elias, was there not, who was one of the immediate successors or followers of Francis, who wanted to sort of organise things, you know, be far more organised. And this kind of conflict between the freedom of the poor man, the little poor man, and the desire to, in a sense, institutionalise, Benedictinise the Franciscan experience. And of course, if the Franciscan charism is to be carried on into the world, it has to find institutional forms in which to incarnate itself, you know, that Franciscans don't wander around on walking down the highways and byways begging now, like they might have done in the medieval period. They have to adapt.
Yet, however different their charisms and way of life might be, one thing totally unites every Benedictine and every Franciscan. That is, the realization at the deepest levels of their beings that God is everything. We are as Benedictine.